This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, what we actually know about social media and kids' brains. Hi, I am back from maternity leave. I had a baby. He's great. Now, for my first episode back, I wanted to talk about a topic that I've been thinking about a lot as a new parent, and that's phones, screens, social media. My son is just 6 months old, and already he's so curious about my phone. He grabs at it all the time. When it lights up, he lights up. And it just makes me feel like, ooh, this is just the beginning, isn't it?
Hi, my name is Chris. I've got two daughters.
Hi, my name is Sue McGorry. I have three daughters.
My name is Joe. I have three kids, 11, 8, and 6.
7 and 10-year-old.
9 and 12.
The social media thing has already started. Kids are on Snapchat.
Instagram.
TikTok is their main drug of choice.
We have attempted to employ social media and smartphone rules.
Can we not give them a phone until they hit high school?
I kept them off social media until 12th grade.
I have tried to ban TikTok as much as I possibly could.
The backlash I got was very strong.
I don't think my husband and I were really prepared.
We weren't prepared to even be able to practice what we were expecting our kids to do.
I really worry about the impacts of social media.
I think it's really hard to be a kid nowadays.
We need to teach kids what this means.
We're still learning.
I'm at the very beginning of this journey, and I don't know where to start.
Those are just some of the people who responded when we asked listeners, tell us about your rules around social media with your kids. This has got to be one of the most complicated things for modern parents to navigate. Recently, the Surgeon General said social media platforms should come with a warning label for young people, the way we have warning labels on cigarettes or alcohol. So far, that's just a proposal, but it got parents talking about how social media makes their kids feel.
Most kids tell us they try to go on for 20 minutes, they're sucked in for 3 hours, they feel miserable about themselves as a result.
That's Mitch Prinstein, chief science officer at the American Psychological Association and a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of North Carolina. Mitch has been studying adolescent brains for 20 years, specifically how their relationships to their peers affect development, both online and off. He's also in the thick of this at home. He's got two kids, a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old.
These platforms, most of them, are now geared towards keeping your kids on for as long as humanly possible. And it doesn't seem like there's a willingness to change that. So you weren't wrong to give your kids a device and to give your kids access to social media. But in the absence of anyone else doing anything about it right now, I'm afraid that it's up to us to have to be the gatekeepers.
Mitch has practical gatekeeping tips for parents to consider. And we'll hear from some young people about what they wish we, the adults and the rulemakers, knew about what their social media lives are really like. But first, let's dive into the science. What we know about both the good and the bad when it comes to kids and social media.
Let me start with the benefits. I mean, I do think that social media gives us an opportunity to connect with people we might not meet in our day-to-day lives, in our neighborhoods, let's say. And there's some evidence that that's really important. Kids are able to find others who might have a similar identity or are experiencing similar struggles. And we've seen a number of civic engagement and activism that's kind of started online, and kids being able to create community and global movements that we never could have done without social media. Now, on the flip side, we have data to say that if you're going on there mostly to lurk and look at others and compare yourselves and try and get more followers to your feed, that's a bad way of using social media. That is related to more depression and anxiety over time. If you're using it to spread or observe cyber hate, discrimination, even the bystanders, those who are just seeing others getting discriminated against, they're experiencing more anxiety and depression. But maybe most concerning is the kids who are using it so much that they can't stop. Because that we're starting to see is actually potentially changing how the adolescent brain grows. It's changing the way in which certain regions mature over time, creating folks who might be hypersensitive and hyper-focused on themselves and their platforms and really have a lower development of that prefrontal cortex area. And the reason why that's important is because one of the last areas of the brain to develop is the prefrontal cortex. And that's the brain's brakes that stops us from engaging in every impulsive behavior or seeking every momentary desire that we want.
Right. Pretty useful part.
It's pretty important, right? And we're really excited when we see that all that we do as parents is working, because if you show kids images of things that are risky or dangerous or immoral, you can see in a brain image scan that the prefrontal cortex is being activated. Except if you show them those same images with a lot of likes attached to it, then you see that prefrontal cortex shut down. So we're really seeing that social media is changing how the brain is processing information. Right now, the experience of an 8-year-old on social media is no different than a 58-year-old, right? It's not made for kids. So they're exposed to the full adult version of these platforms, but their brains aren't adult yet.
Explain a little bit more of that mechanism, if you can. What is it about seeing all those likes that overrides the part of the brain that's supposed to be able to recognize something harmful or not right is happening?
When you're talking about the parts of the brain that are developing, the first area that changes, what's actually changing there is that there's this sudden increase in oxytocin and dopamine receptors. And what that means is that suddenly we really crave social interactions with peers. And it feels really, really good when we get attention and reinforcement from them. Now, that's a natural, normal experience. Even mice are more interested in hanging out with other adolescent mice during their adolescence than they are with adult mice, right? So that's all okay. But we're not used to this brain living in a world where you can 24/7 press buttons to get followers and reposts and whatnot. A lot of the platforms are not really cultivating what all of this was built for in the first place, neurologically, I mean. It was built this way to help us establish autonomy and develop much more complex interpersonal relationships, not just to pursue numbers and follower counts. So it's kind of hijacking the part of the brain that's supposed to help us develop meaningful social skills, and it's instead directing us to use that neural incentive to develop these more meaningless social skills.
What else does the research say about how social media affects young people? Like, what can we definitively say?
So we're trying to move away from some simplistic questions like, you know, is 25 minutes on TikTok worse or better than 26 minutes on TikTok, right? That's kind of somewhere the old research started, really just focused on screen time. But we now know that you have to look at which content, which features, which functions might be helpful or harmful to which kids. Perhaps most important for me as a scientist and as a parent is the extent to which that focus on engagement is keeping kids away from other activities they should be doing. Sleep, physical exercise, and in-person interaction probably being the biggest ones. When kids don't get the sleep they're supposed to be getting, it actually changes the size of their brain growth. So that's important. We're seeing ways that kids are experiencing a remarkable amount of stress because they're getting, and we adults can understand this, we're getting notifications constantly. We feel like we have to keep up to date on all those notifications, right? And for kids, the stakes are high. They are very interested in being in the know socially. So to ask them to get off their phones for a few hours is like taking away the most important thing for them, the thing that's going to give them the most reinforcement biologically even.
Yeah, I'm glad you're saying that because I feel like sometimes in these conversations, I can hear some dismissal of the way that young people move around in the world and move around their social circles and sort of, you know, oh, these kids are so attached to whatever it is, to messaging their friends. But I mean, to your point, it's so important to them for a reason, for a biological reason, for a lot of good reasons too. Availability to all your friends all the time. Why wouldn't a kid want that, right?
And why wouldn't we want that for them, really? I mean, you know, when kids start rolling their eyes at their parents at 10 or 11, I tell them, that's a great sign that your kid's brain is developing exactly the way it's supposed to be, right? That means their brains are maturing to orient them towards peers. They're going to learn new skills. I mean, it doesn't feel so good to get your eyes, someone roll their eyes at you, but that's a great sign for kids' development. And if it was just instant messaging and texting, we actually don't have any data to say that there's a problem there. It's the AI and the like button and the follower count and the visual nature of the medium that allows you to put up selfie photos. Those are the things that we're seeing are actually having some of the more concerning effects on kids' development.
So I know that you've looked at the research, but you've also talked about the gaps in the research. What don't we know? What don't we understand about how social media is affecting young people?
I mean, it's really important to be clear that we don't have the kinds of causal evidence that some people are asking for, because the only way that scientists feel comfortable about making a causal conclusion is to randomly assign some kids into a high social media condition and others into a low social media condition, and then wait a few years and see what happens to them. And obviously, that would be very unethical. They have done the reverse. They have had randomly taking some kids off of their normal social media use, and others, they just let them do what they're normally doing. And those results are starting to show that kids do improve when they're off social media. So I think we're getting closer to causal mechanisms.
Well, improve in what, I should ask?
Well, that there's definitely some content and some functions that are leading kids to feel more lonely, more anxious, more depressed. There are aspects to social media that are really creating social comparison and of your social life, of your body shape. There are some aspects that are creating this undue stress and pressure. And kids getting a break from that is so important.
I've also read some criticism of, you know, and this goes to the point of just, do we have all the data, really? I've read some mental health experts hypothesize that maybe we're being too quick to blame social media for all these issues, and maybe it has to do with other factors that are impacting young people today. I mean, we are all so much more aware of mental health today than we were a decade ago, certainly more than that. Therapy speak has become sort of normalized now for a lot of people. I mean, what do you say to the people who say, hold on, are we being too quick to blame social media for this?
Yeah, let's be very clear. Social media is not the sole cause of the youth mental health crisis. I mean, that's just silly. We have decades of research to demonstrate that youth mental health has been a concern long before social media or phones or the pandemic. I think that social media may be exacerbating a problem that's been there for a very, very long time. I also think that there are some kids that are especially vulnerable to social media. But to say that social media by itself has caused all of the difficulties that all kids are experiencing now, I just think that that's not consistent with the scientific evidence to date.
Well, so given the complications of the fact that, you know, like you're describing, social media use in and of itself isn't even all equal. Depends on how you are using it, in fact. I wonder what you think about the blanket warning that the Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, suggested recently. He called for a warning label to be placed on social media platforms to warn about the effects on young people for their mental health. Now, this is something that would take congressional action to actually do, but it was certainly a provocative suggestion. What do you make of it?
Well, I think about the Surgeon General's suggestion in the context of what I know he's heard, and also I and many of my colleagues have heard when you go out and you speak with communities who are wrestling with this. Parents feel so incredibly hopeless, powerless against these enormous tech companies that have taken hold of their kids' attention, purportedly to keep their kids engaged for as long as possible. If the Surgeon General's warning was meant to empower parents and school administrators to say, you know, I don't care how much you tantrum, I'm not letting you do this for 5 hours a day, then I think that's great. Can we say that social media is harmful to every single individual? We can't say that right now, however.
As you can probably tell by now, Mitch doesn't like to paint things with a broad brush. But there's lots of different kinds of harm kids can encounter online. And he says it's not so much a question of if your kid will be exposed to something harmful, but when.
50% of kids are exposed to content that teaches them how to engage in dangerous and disruptive behaviors. A high percentage of kids are exposed to predators. Many kids are reporting that they see discrimination.
This is partly what the Surgeon General's proposal is trying to address, the negative impact on kids' mental health from being exposed to this kind of content on social media. There's other kinds of action being considered, too. There's been bipartisan interest in a bill called the Kids Online Safety Act. It would require social media platforms to make changes like limiting notifications and adding parental controls. There's been some criticism that the bill promotes censorship. But Mitch is in favor of putting the onus on social media companies to make their platforms safer for young people.
What most people don't realize is there's absolutely no oversight whatsoever when it comes to social media. And there's absolutely no law to ensure that that is going to happen. So a modicum of regulation, oversight, to put child safety and well-being above profit feels like a very small but reasonable request.
And he says some of these changes would be so easy for these social media companies to make.
They already tag every post that comes in. They can take down cyber hate. They can take down the posts that teach kids how to cut themselves and hide it from their parents, or how to engage in anorexia behaviors. Take all that down right away.
Meanwhile, some school districts are taking it upon themselves to make their own policies around devices. Earlier this summer, Los Angeles, which is the second largest school district in the country, banned smartphones during the school day, starting in 2025. There's also a growing parent movement, with some groups recommending strict guidelines like no social media until 16 and no phones after 8 p.m. I asked Mitch what he thinks of some of the guidance he's seeing coming out of these advocacy groups.
I mean, we've seen a number of things over the last year that have been, in my opinion, heading in the right direction, and some things that don't seem very well conceived. I think shutting off social media to everyone and anyone below a certain age doesn't make a lot of sense, and it doesn't fit the science. First of all, kids develop competencies at all different rates. And while one child might not be ready for what they're going to experience until they're 16, there might be others who are ready when they're 13. And there might be families that say, given my child and what they're experiencing, and that they're the only one who looks like them or has their identity in their community, there may be ways in which supervised, limited interaction at a younger age is perfectly appropriate. Hmm. It's also concerning that if you shut everything off till 16, come on, we are all adolescents. You know exactly what that's going to do. It's going to make every 13-year-old think it's the coolest thing to find a way on there.
Right.
And it conveys the idea that once you hit 16, it's perfectly safe and fine, which it's not. So that's a wrong way. I think a right way would be the way that we think about driving, or we teach kids about other behaviors that could be risky, but you need to teach them how to do it the right way. Let's build digital media literacy into every school. Even better, let's build it into the social media programs themselves. And the last thing I'll say is that the Netherlands, the UK, France, they're all starting to take phones out of the classroom. And that's well-founded in psychological science as well. There's no such thing as multitasking. There's only task shifting. And kids are not as good at task shifting as adults are. So to expect a kid to learn organic chemistry, well, period, but certainly while they're scrolling through their social media at the same time, there's just no argument that I'm aware of to suggest that that's a good idea.
Mm. And what about these school policies, like you've mentioned, that you think it's a good idea for them to not use their phones during school hours? Obviously, you're going to see mixed results across different places. In some places, kids who've been interviewed are saying things like, yeah, we get it. We were on our phones a lot before. We can see it now. And in other places, you see kids really reacting quite badly to having something taken away from them, especially at the high school level, when they feel like they should be treated with more respect like young adults. How do you talk to young people about something like this, about why these bans are in place?
In the context of some of the data that we've been getting, I think about that in a slightly different way. In our own research lab at UNC, but also when reviewing the studies that have been done around the world, A lot of people have taken the diagnostic criteria for substance dependency. But instead of asking questions about cocaine or alcohol or nicotine, they've subbed in the word social media. I then ask kids to respond to whether they think they might fit each of those diagnostic criteria. Things like, I try to quit, but I can't. Or I spend a lot of time thinking about how I'm going to get access back when I'm away from it. Or when I'm doing it, it doesn't give me the same feeling that I had before. I have to do more and more of it in order to get the same reaction. These symptoms of dependency and withdrawal and tolerance are being reported at a remarkably high level by kids. In fact, in some samples, well over 90% of kids are saying, I can't quit, even though I'm trying to limit my usage. And in other studies, about 50% are reporting at least one symptom of clinical dependency. I've presented in front of so many different groups of youth and school personnel and parents and other stakeholder groups as well. And I always ask kids to raise their hands if they feel that they might be addicted to their social media feeds. And almost every single kid raises their hand. In that context, I think we're having a discussion about how do we help kids use their devices when they want to use them? Not because they feel pulled to or they're getting notifications in the middle of the day, but when they choose to and when it makes them feel good. And I think most kids would agree that although they, in some ways, feel tied to these devices 24/7, they would like a break.
So much of this conversation is happening among the adults, the lawmakers, the doctors. But what do the kids think about all this policy talk that's going on around them? My team and I decided to do some very unofficial surveying. We spoke to some of the teenagers we know, and we asked them about their social media use.
I'm 16. I'm on Instagram, TikTok.
I'm 15 years old. I use TikTok, Snapchat, and Instagram mostly.
I use TikTok, Snapchat, and Instagram.
I can only use Snapchat for 20 minutes a day, and I can only use YouTube for 30 minutes a day.
I try to keep it under like 2 to 3 hours a day max.
I was on Instagram 7 hours today.
Connecting with my friends via like funny memes and images.
I like getting a lot of like outfit inspo and just like kind of lifestyle stuff.
There's a lot of supportive people helping each other.
I also have found many content creators that have like really stuck out to me. They've made me feel like they've made me learn something.
I would not know what's going on in the world without TikTok.
But I think there are more negatives than positives.
There are a lot of downsides, and like social media can be very toxic.
There's a lot of like just degenerate activities happen that can go onto your For You page. There's a lot of hate, like in comment sections.
There's always going to be comments that like are negative, no matter what.
I think when I post something and it doesn't get as many like likes or comments, I'm like, oh, I don't look as good in this. I need to like take it down.
People can do whatever they want to try and ban phones, but I think we're already at a point where we're so addicted, we're going to find ways to get our phones back.
Clearly, teens are struggling with this just as much as the adults are. So I asked Mitch to give us his best advice for parents on how to help their kids by establishing some rules. And I started with what feels like the big question: what age should a child be before they get a smartphone?
Okay, let me tell you some science. We have no data to suggest that kids without a smartphone or without social media access are suffering in any way whatsoever.
Are you sure? Because they say they are. Mom or dad. Everyone else has one, right?
And that's the number one reason why parents give in. But it's important for parents to know there's no data to support that. They may feel like they're a little bit out of the loop. But when we talk with kids, they say their friends are actually very accommodating of saying, oh, here's what happened that you missed, or I'm going to send you a text. And sometimes they say, actually, once I hear about how silly it is and what nonsense and drama there is, I'm kind of happy that I'm not on there. So we're even seeing that some of the most popular and well-adjusted kids are not on because they see it as being so superficial and sometimes fake. So anyway, I would say there's really no reason why a kid needs this before 9th grade, before 13 or so.
So what should parents be assessing to decide, you know what, I think my kid can be on social media now.
Does your child make decisions about their social lives in a way that is not unduly influenced by their peers' preferences, choices, right? It's normal to be susceptible to peer influence at this age, but unduly so. That even beyond their better judgment, they're going to stay on longer. They're going to post things they shouldn't. They're going to like things that they shouldn't. That's a question. Does your child understand what's real and what's fake of what they see? Are adults understanding what's real and what's fake from what they see? That's a really important question. And if the answer is no, that the child doesn't understand, does the parent have the time to talk once a week in detail about, tell me a little bit about what was like it was like for you on social media this week? What'd you see? What didn't you see? What do you think was real? What wasn't? How do you make sense of it? I fully respect that some parents don't have the time to do that. I would say in that case, maybe a good place to start is just a dinner table conversation without devices, where parents talk about their own experiences on social media. And they say, here's why I go on. Here's when I think I need to get off. Here's what I look for. Here's what I don't. Here's what I think is silly. Here's what I think is important and why it's meaningful. And let kids start learning from their parents how to use it in a way that's consistent with that family's values and preferences.
Can I tell you what I feel like if a lot of us were being really honest with ourselves? I think a lot of adults would realize that they have a problem. I think a lot of adults and parents struggle with this themselves. So how can we be good models to our kids if we don't kind of look within ourselves very critically?
I think that's the insight right there. These conversations will do exactly what you say. It will make us all realize, wait a minute, I need some rules here. I need some limits, and I need to talk about how hard it is. Let me give you an example. During the pandemic, we made conscious the concept of doom scrolling. We made a word for it, and we all started talking with each other about it, and suddenly we were able to override it. We said, I'm doom scrolling, stop it. And once we made it something that we were monitoring, it changed our behavior, and it created a dialogue of what's healthy and what's not. We need more of that.
What do you say to those parents who might be feeling like, I think it's too late? You know, the cat's out of the bag, the kid has the smartphone, the kid has social media accounts, and now I'm sort of rethinking things. What's your advice to them?
Yeah, you know, we hear that a lot. I would say start with something small, which might be hard to do, but say as a full family, we're going to put our social media or our devices away at 10 o'clock at night. That seems reasonable, right? We all should be getting sleep. It's important for our health. It affects every aspect of our behavior, our body, and certainly for developing brains. Let's just all decide, let's do it for a day or two. Let's put them away. And then let's have a family conversation about why that was hard and what was easy and how do we want to adjust it. Most kids tell us they try to go on for 20 minutes. They're sucked in for 3 hours. They feel miserable about themselves as a result. So let's just monitor ourselves and each other.
How do you think about balancing young people's desire for privacy in all of this?
Yeah, I'm definitely not suggesting that parents look over their kids' shoulders or that they get in there and read what's happening. And in fact, I can tell you from our research that even if you think you're reading your kids' texts and feeds and all that, you're not, because most all kids tell us they have accounts and feeds that their parents don't know about. But it's more about talking about it and telling kids, I'm the person you should come and talk to with questions. So let's just assume the worst in a preemptive conversation or several conversations with kids to say, what do you do if someone asks for your address? What do you do if you can't verify who they are in real life and they want to become friends and start meeting you outside of school or home? What do you do when you see somebody say something cruel to a person because of their identity or their demographic difference? Those are conversations that need to happen in the same way we talk about what would you do if there was no designated driver? We need to prepare our kids how to live in this world safely.
If all of this still feels daunting, you might find it reassuring to know that we also heard from some parents who said, you know what? we've landed on some rules in our house that we think are working for our kids. Here's what one listener, Marisol, told us.
What has really, really helped is no electronic Sunday. We don't let them to be on phones, computers, iPads, nothing. A day to maybe listen to music, allowed to go to the park, be on your bike outside. Cool, better teenage kid stuff like that. That's definitely worked.
Another listener, Vanessa, has found that lots of talking has helped her family.
We've tried to evolve our attitude to leveraging social media as a way to connect with our kids more. Then they're more open to sharing what they're doing online. We'll talk about our own experiences. I share stories about maybe when I've overshared something on social media and how it affected me. My kids are going to make mistakes, but I at least have more confidence now than when I did in 2020 that they'll come to me or my husband if something doesn't seem right online.
Mitch says, if all of this feels hard, it's because it is hard. Parents are just trying to do their best.
It's so important to know your child is biologically programmed to want to have social interaction. It's okay that they're gravitating towards this. And parents want to make their kids happy and give them a wonderful childhood experience. It's okay that you allowed your child to have access to a tool that would fit their biological needs and potentially make them happy. There's nothing that you've done that's wrong. What's happened that's inappropriate is the way that these platforms, most of them, are now geared towards keeping your kids on for as long as humanly possible. And it doesn't seem like there's a willingness to change that. Mm. So you weren't wrong to give your kids a device and to give your kids access to social media. But in the absence of anyone else doing anything about it right now, I'm afraid that it's up to us to have to be the gatekeepers and to teach our kids how to use this with moderation, with safety, and to help them save themselves from incredibly powerful algorithms that we're only just learning how they work. Mm. It's not your fault, but it is an opportunity to help your kids learn how to do this in a good way.
Mitch, thank you so much for this conversation. This was really interesting.
Oh, thank you.
Dr. Mitch Prinstein is the chief science officer at the American Psychological Association and a professor of psychology and neuroscience at UNC Chapel Hill. You can find a link with more resources for parents on our show notes page. And thanks to all of you who called in and shared your stories. And to our teens who talked to us about how they're feeling.